Hello, and thanks for downloading the No Bullshit Leadership podcast. If you're interested in learning more about the life-changing power of great leadership, I have two exciting pieces of news. The first is that my new book, No Bullshit Change, is out now in hardback, Kindle, or on Audible. And the second is that I've launched a brand new online No Bullshit Leadership training program. It's designed for anybody who has ambitions they want to fulfill, places they want to go, and people they want to help thrive. If that's you, head over to my website, chris-hurst.com, to sign up for more information. That's chris-hurst.com. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hello, I'm Chris Hurst, and welcome to the No Bullshit Leadership podcast brought to you by Intelligence Squared. Leadership is difficult, but not complicated. And I want to help cut through the bullshit to get to the heart of modern leadership, which, put simply, is the power to get stuff done and make stuff happen. In each episode, I'm joined by a different inspirational leader who is doing just that, leading change in their worlds of business, sport, or politics. And my guest today is Justine Roberts, the founder and CEO of Mumsnet. Since launch in 2000, Mumsnet has grown into a social network for parents with over 5 million visits a month and users contributing over 25,000 posts every day. Mumsnet has become one of the most influential voices in the UK, regularly setting the national media agenda on behalf of its community and parents across the country. It is now an essential, if intimidating, port of call for party leaders in every general election. Justine was awarded a CBE in 2017 for services to the economy. Welcome to the podcast, Justine.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
So today you're nationally famous as the founder of Mumsnet, but your first job, as I understand it, was in finance, where you were one of only two women, I think, on the trading floor you worked on. And I was actually also delighted to read that you were at some point a cricket reporter. So you've had what seems to me like a pretty varied and interesting career even before Mumsnet. Yet you've been quoted as saying that you never really felt like you had a good cultural fit with those organisations or perhaps those careers. Can you tell us a little bit about your time before Mumsnet?
Yeah, sure. So I think I went into the city because I really didn't know what to do and I wanted to basically move out of home. I'd done a very brief bit of work experience as a market maker, which is one of the people who set the prices on the floor of a stock exchange. And I quite enjoyed myself. But they were very male. I think the sort of underlying factor of all these careers I picked very early on, including sports reporting, football and cricket writing, was they were really male dominated. And that it was very unusual to be a woman at that time doing this stuff. And I think I had a massive point to prove. And that's why I did them. I was just trying to prove that I could do it as well as the guys. There were many aspects to it, which were deeply difficult and uncomfortable as a woman in those, you know, environments, which were really misogynistic, but also quite homophobic and racist and all the other things that kind of 1980s and 90s Britain was, and particularly these very male-dominated environments, before any sense of, well, some people would call it wokeism, but I might call it how to behave.
Well, my next question, which I think I've got a reasonable idea of the answer to already, my next question was going to be, why did you eventually leave finance? But I guess that might be at least part of the reason.
Yeah, it was. But the main catalyst was I got pregnant, actually. And I was very clear in my head that it was no place to sort of raise a family if you're a woman. And there were a few women who'd reached the top, very few, but they basically did it by denying their family existed. So they would work even longer hours, they would never get home for bath time, they would be working all weekend up at the crack of dawn. And I just thought, this is not going to work. This is not what I want to do. And it's sort of, in a way, getting pregnant and having a sort of change imposed upon me was quite useful because it creates a natural break where you take a pause and think, look, is this really me? And I sort of resoundingly came down on, no, it's not really me. I need to do something else.
And so what came first then, or maybe it wasn't quite as binary as this, but was it the idea for Mumsnet that came first? Or was it the idea that I need to go and work for myself? Or even was it just less concrete even than that, that I just need to go and do something else and I need to find out what that is?
Yeah, it was less concrete. I never thought, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. I think women sort of are quite reluctant to call themselves entrepreneurs, really. But as far as I was concerned, I was just started something to try and solve a problem. And I often joke that men open a cupboard door and call themselves entrepreneurs, but women are a bit reluctant. But I was fulfilling a need that I myself had, which I think is often the case for people who start businesses. I needed advice from other parents who'd been there and done that. And the internet had just started, and it seemed like a very good place to be able to tap into the advice of others.
And so was there a kind of an obvious catalytic moment then for when Mumsnet was born, if you excuse the pun, in your mind?
I think it was, I don't know if you remember back then, Chris, but it was like the gold rush days of the internet. Everyone had a web idea. Everyone had an idea for their website. I was, in a way, in a fortunate position that I was in a natural pause in my career. As it turned out to be really bad timing, because the dot-com crash happened within 6 months of us launching, and we never really managed to raise any cash. So it wasn't the great moment I thought it was, but in a way, it all worked out.
Yeah, so that was going to be my understanding is your initial sort of plan A, if you like, as you say, in 1999, which was the sort of first gold rush era of the internet, I suppose. You set out, I suppose, what I would describe as a fairly conventional approach to launching a business. You said, okay, I have a business plan, I have an idea, I have a plan, I need to go and raise some funds. You wanted to raise, I think, £4 or 5 million. And then dot-com bubble burst, and I guess that raising funds for internet companies became extremely difficult. So you then moved to plan B, I guess. So can you just talk us through that a little bit in terms of how your thinking and your, I suppose, approach to the business changed?
No, I think I was never that sure about raising lots of money, but it was very much in the sort of prevailing wind that you had to grow as fast and as big as you possibly could. And it was known as land grab. So you would stake out your territory, but like the Wild West. And there was an advantage to the first mover. I wrote a business plan that really wasn't worth the paper it was written on. I think even now we're just about making the e-commerce revenues that we predicted in year three of my business plan way back then. And I hadn't really factored in was the fact that everyone was on dial-up. Lots of people hadn't even adopted the internet.
Smartphones didn't exist, did they?
No, exactly. So you had to be quite sort of persistent to even try and do any kind of online commerce. And then, of course, there was no money. To be fair, there was a period when other people were raising money and I wasn't. And I think a lot of that was because I didn't quite look or sound the part. And a lot of the money was coming from, as it still does, actually, the venture market, where there are very few women and they didn't really get women's problems. So I remember someone did actually offer me the money, but said that he wanted someone else to run the business, and that someone was a 25-year-old man who didn't have kids. So I didn't.
Amazing.
Anyway, it all turned out for the best, really, because frankly, it soon became apparent that the business model was not right. Had we raised money, we would have been like many other startups at that time that got a fancy office in Clerkenwell, hired 100 people, and then realised that they actually weren't making any revenue and would have gone bust, and I would have had to lay people off. So it was for the best. We quickly began to realise that Mumsnet, even though we couldn't work out the economics of it, was proving to be quite useful. So I think in answer to your question, why didn't I just give up? Even 6 months in, it became apparent that it was going to actually be useful to people. People were getting answers to their questions, and they were important questions in their life. So we actually sort of begged and borrowed for the first 5 years, including sort of asking users to contribute. And these checks used to arrive for 250 quid and just from someone saying, you've been a lifesaver to me. So we were in a way fortunate that we didn't raise money, because I think I wonder whether we'd be here now had we raised that money in the beginning.
And so given the, well, I say the centrality, the clue is in the name, Mumsnet is a community that you've created, a huge and growing community. How do you see your relationship, particularly as a leader? Do they lead you? Do you lead them? Is it symbiotic, the relationship?
We try and reflect the voice of the community. So one of our kind of core goals is to raise women's voices. So we're very much user led. And I think part of the, one of the good reasons, again, about not raising money and our users financially supporting the site was that they very clearly became stakeholders very early on. So that's how I would view it. I would say our community is a very important stakeholder and they are empowered to make choices about the site and always have been. So a lot of our decisions about who we work with in terms of advertisers have been put to the community and they have basically been the arbiters of what type of work we do and who we do it with. And that's still the case.
How formal do you make that process? Do you actively have a process that says we're listening to what people are talking about, people are worrying about, people are asking about, and therefore we should build this new product or go in this new direction or change in some way to reflect that?
I think it's more embedded in our culture. So we have a culture deck and we outline everything, all the behaviours we want to see in our team. And it's a bit like, do you remember Amazon always used to put an empty chair in every meeting, which was supposed to symbolize the customer? Everyone would always think about what the customer, how the customer would think about this if they were listening in. And I think it's a bit like that. It's utterly embedded in what we do and our choices. Now, we also, Mumsday is effectively a 24/7 focus group. So it's very... There is no, we don't have to go and ask. We get told quite a lot of what we should be campaigning on, what we should be building, who we should work with, what we should and shouldn't do. The difficulty comes in where there isn't consensus because it's 6 million users and they are from all political persuasions and they have very often very conflicting views about things. So we kind of have a set of principles that we'll campaign on things, but it has to be something that's where there's a good majority feel in favour and that there isn't a kind of 25% who utterly feel completely polarised by this. So we, for instance, could not have campaigned on Brexit because it was so polarised and it was on Mumsnet as it was in the rest of the country. So we stay away from things where there is division and we focus our energy on things where the majority, and by that at least 80% of our users, are in strong agreement and the rest aren't that bothered, if you know what I mean.
So you mentioned culture a couple of minutes ago, and I'm a passionate advocate or believer, whatever word you want to choose, about the power of organizational culture. All organizations have a culture, in my opinion. It's just that some have a good culture and some have a bad culture. But as soon as you have a group of people together over a prolonged period of time, a culture evolves. You talked about having a very deliberate approach to the culture at Mumsnet. Can you just describe that a little for me?
Yeah, I think it took a while to get there, to be honest. I think you're right. All organizations had a culture, but we were not aware of ours and we were not aware of what we wanted it to be and how we might nudge it along until really an epiphany in sort of around 2014, 2015. So before that, I would just describe Mumsnet as having a very sort of English, nice, flexible, nice culture. And that actually was quite crippling in many ways because everyone was in a very English way, so scared of saying anything critical. Because we're all told, particularly I think women are all told, and we had a lot of women working for us, as you can imagine, that if you haven't got anything nice to say, don't say it at all. And that's kind of the opposite of actually how people grow and develop, is this sort of let's not give any feedback because we might hurt someone's feelings kind of thing. So that was one of the major motivations for sort of trying to get to grips with it. And actually, I was inspired really by Netflix, who had done a culture deck, which is kind of warts and all. And we use ours as much to say who won't fit in here as to say, come and join us. It's not a pitch. And we are very aware that some of the elements of our culture deck are a work in progress for us, like the ones about feedback. We still have to work really hard at it because we default to this thing that's ingrained in us, which is don't criticise, don't criticise. So we've adopted a kind of number of things. I'll give you an example. We just have a deck which has what our values are, what we believe in, and then some examples of how to behave and how not to behave. So one of them is we'd rather have a hole than an arsehole for our hiring. So we've made loads of mistakes over the year where we just think we've desperately got to fill this position, knowing the person that we're hiring isn't quite right. And it always comes back to haunt you, that type of decision. And the other is, we say computer says yes. So we're always trying to, instead of just saying it can't be done, trying to work out a way of how it can be done. And all the feedback stuff, which, as I say, is a work in progress. And we've adopted something called radical candor, which is all about a combination of management, sort of both caring personally, but giving direct and candid feedback in the moment as a development thing. And we're trying to all sort of repeat the mantra that feedback is a gift, not a criticism. So lots of things, but I have to say it took me a while to get there. And everyone said Mumset was nice, a nice place to work, but I'm not sure it was what people really want from the workplace. I think is amazing colleagues and to feel a sense of progress and development and that they're working for something with purpose. And I think for that to happen, we have to have a mechanism for giving feedback so people can grow.
Fascinating listening to you, because I agree with every single word you've said. My understanding is pretty well exactly as you described it, which is it's about creating an environment where we can achieve things we wouldn't otherwise achieve. We want somewhere where, of course, we're happy and we enjoy being there, but also that is helping us achieve whatever our individual personal goals might be. And these days, we maybe all have quite different ones. And I also think that a great culture can disagree without falling out, which is my version a bit of your feedback. I think a great culture has to be able to be honest with each other. As you say, you can be honest without being a dick. And it is difficult to do well. It is difficult to be able to have honest conversations with each other. But if you don't, that's when the resentments and the politics and all that stuff builds up, doesn't it? Because the feelings don't go away. They just get hidden and bottled up, and resentment builds up. And I also feel that culture is nearly always a continual work in progress. It has to be just always on the to-do list. You can't think, oh yeah, tick, we've done culture, let's move on. It's so central. And you talked in there about purpose as well. You talked again in the past, I think, about choosing purpose over profit. What is Mumsnet's purpose today?
Well, our overriding purpose is to make parents' lives easier by facilitating the connections that allow them to tap into the wisdom of each other. I think it's quite interesting because obviously we are a social platform and they've come under a lot of scrutiny for the moderation that occurs on them. And I think where we have always been slightly different to many of the often larger platforms, frankly, is that we have invested in moderation and we have made value-laden decisions about the type of content that we are going to take down. So we have put ourselves into that sort of space which the bigger platforms have tried to shy away from, which is we're not just a dumb pipe. This is a value-laden decision. And we will explain how we do it. But the one that trumps everything in the end is it making parents' lives easier. So sometimes you can get tied up in rules and regulations and has someone broken the language of what you've said you'll allow. Moderation is very difficult if you get tied up in that kind of language. And what we've always tried to do, therefore, is say, in the end, we get to decide and we'll base it on our core purpose, which is this making parents' lives easier. And that's the way we moderate. And it's hard work because you're dealing with a lot of individuals who have different opinions about what type of information should be allowed on Mumsnet and what shouldn't and all the rest of it. But I think we have invested in that, and that's why we're still here. And that's why Mumsnet still, even though I know it can be feisty, is a pretty civilized place to hang out and where people can get genuine help. Because I think we've invested in that value-laden moderation, which is all comes down to what our purpose is and why we're here.
I'll go back a few years again now. So you start to build this community. You're in your bedroom initially, but the community grows and grows. Eventually by 2006, you had David Cameron, I think, on there. So then you're 6 years after launch, really starting to cut through in a big way. At what point did you start to work out how to make money as a business out of the community?
Well, I think you need scale to make money out of advertising, and we got scale. So it wasn't, I don't think it was any sort of epiphany. It was just, And also we caught a wave, to be honest, of the switch from print advertising to digital. So without making too much effort, brands would come to us, to be honest. It wasn't a major focus for us, how to make money. And again, probably because we didn't have investors and we were tied up with growing and doing a good job and campaigning and stuff like that. that we probably didn't give a lot of thought to monetization. But it was good. I remember in 2008, we could finally move out of the back bedroom into an office. And we got a big book deal, actually, with Bloomsbury. I'm slightly embarrassed about it, really, because we didn't really think a lot about it. We thought about who we wouldn't work with. But basically, I suppose it wasn't our major focus, but the model became obvious because brands came to us.
And I'm sure as well that you are a very public figure in the sense that you are intimately associated with Mumsnet. You are the personification, perhaps, of Mumsnet as the founder and leader. And are you conscious of that? And are you conscious of that in terms of your own leadership style?
I'm conscious of the fact that I'm no longer the appropriate demographic, I think, to be the spokesperson. Very conscious of that. I think all this stuff is a journey. I am more conscious than I was and actually had to go through a whole sort of reprogramming of myself and a big learning exercise where I had to admit that I thought a particularly ineffective leader, actually, for about the first sort of 12 to 15 years of my, I was a classic founder where I was involved in everything, thought I had to make every decision, wasn't very good at feedback, wasn't very good, just tended to sort of plow on and make all the decisions and not really trust anyone. And I sort of went on a course and I realised this and it dawned on me and I thought, well, have I got the capacity to actually be different, or is it so ingrained in me? And maybe there are some people who are just better at starting things than running things. And do I even want to? Because it's like I've got to reprogram myself and this is going to be hard. And I'm going to have to face up to the fact that I don't have all the answers, or rather I shouldn't have all the answers because the organisation will never scale. And as I say, it's a work in progress. But so I suppose what I'm saying is, I think your question was, does it make me behave differently? I think we all have a responsibility to understand that whoever's in charge of an organisation is a role model and needs to keep learning and try to understand that they, just because people look up to you doesn't mean you're deserving of their respect.
Very wise words. So now then, in 2022, how would you describe yourself as a leader? By the way, in full disclosure, I hate it when people ask me that sort of question. So there you go. That's an insight to me.
Look, we have written down, as many organisations have, our values, and they are my values, really. They're partly aspirational, but they're partly what we think we are and what we believe in. And so my leadership style, it should reflect those values because it is what I think, how I want us to behave and how I want myself to behave and how I want everyone who works at Mumsnet to behave. And they are, the most important one is being straight and honest and doing the right thing when no one's looking. But then there's quite a lot about being flexible and pragmatic and not bureaucratic and collaborative. So I think that's how I would like to think that I lead the business. I now have an amazing team, and that is very helpful because I always thought it was very hard to delegate. Maybe just I couldn't delegate, but actually it really helps if you hire people who are really fantastic.
Yes, yes, that helps in many ways. Yes, it really does.
So I think I'm hoping that I'm not the one to ask what my leadership style is, but I'm very conscious that I have to work at it all the time. But I hope I have gone from rather command-controlled style leadership to a more collaborative, a bottom-up approach where we definitely ask everyone in the business to contribute ideas and to set their own. We might have goals, but they set their own path to reaching them, which is ends up with a lot more, I think, innovation. And something you have to do as you scale, because you're not at the coalface anymore, and I'm not the target audience anymore, frankly.
All organisations need hierarchies to function. You can't function without some sort of hierarchy. But I also feel like hierarchies need to be permeable. You need to be able to communicate effectively through those up and down that hierarchy. It's obviously easy to communicate top down, but actually you need to hear it the other way as well. And I think that a lot of organizations and a lot of leaders find that very difficult, but it's incredibly important. Otherwise, really, you have no idea what's going on in your own organization.
I think that's right. And it comes back to this thing of trying to engender a culture of giving feedback with in a sort of safe environment without anyone getting upset, cross or angry at them.
Yes, I was researching my new book and I reread the book by Ed Catmull, who was the founder of Pixar. And he talks very compellingly about culture. Really, it's a book about culture and about how hard they worked to ensure that everybody had a voice all the time.
We've adopted OKRs. In any case, because we've always had a very flexible workforce, we've always focused a bit more on outputs and a bit less on presenteeism and being there. So I think adopting a system where you say, look, here are the company goals. Each team go and make up your quarterly goals to get us closer to the company goals, rather than a list of tasks for everyone, which is what we used to have.
100%. As you say, you've employed all of these fantastically ambitious, capable, intelligent people. And so what's the point in doing that if you don't allow them to go and find their own solutions? They'll inevitably do it far better because they're doing it all day long, every day. But it's easy to say, difficult to do sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah. And the other thing that I think has been really useful, actually, is this, which we stole from Larry Page of Google, which is really ambitious goals. So somehow or other, you have to set people targets that basically they're going to miss, most of the time anyway. And that we had to get around, that was really quite tough for us because everyone was a sort of high achiever and wanted to hit their target. But you have to set such stretch targets that largely they miss. But even in missing, they get a better outcome than had they had a sort of plus 10% type target. And occasionally you get some massive innovation because people are really thinking outside the box to meet a real stretch target. So as long as you can deal with people's disappointment and make them understand, we've had some real step changes because of stretch 10x type targets.
I always think that aiming for best, however you define best, whatever that might be, but if you aim for best, you have to think of transformational solutions. Whereas if you aim for a bit better, you end up with incremental solutions. But also I think, listening to you, that setting of unreasonably ambitious targets, however you want to describe them, is fine as long as that's where culture matters so much, I think. So if as long as the culture is one that ensures that people understand that and don't feel like they're failing, if everybody spends their whole time feeling like failures, that's a bad thing. But if everybody understands that's how we work around here and we define success in here's how we define success for you as an individual, and those two things align, then I think that's great. And I think that's why culture and objectives, it's all kind of, they have such a close and symbiotic relationship.
Exactly right. And I think, you know, we have a quarterly presentation. Everyone does red, amber, green for their OKRs. And it's basically a sea of red and amber with the odd green. But what people talk about is what they've learned, what we've learned from this. We didn't hit it, but we did learn this and we will do it differently next time. And I think it is that that thing which is very hard to do again if you come out of any large sort of traditional organization, which is celebrating mistakes and learnings, in fact, not even viewing them as mistakes, but viewing them as learnings. And I write up a mail to the team every week in which I really celebrate mistakes. Now, obviously, you're making the same mistake every week. You would not be. It is trying to create a culture of, look, it's fine to fail.
I couldn't agree more with that. I read John Cleese said a similar thing. He said, everybody talks about failure, and if you don't learn from failure, it remains just that. Failure, it's about your ability to learn from it that is so important. And I think great organizations are really good at learning. So you're now a leadership icon and inspiration for all sorts of people out there in the UK. Have there been inspirational leaders, inspirational people, mentors that have helped you along the way?
Well, I'm not necessarily accepting the premise of your question. I just wanted to
Come on.
I suppose this is going to sound a bit cheesy, but it's probably true. is my biggest inspiration in running Mumsnet does come from the people on the site who go out of their way to really help each other. In, you know, for no praise, they're anonymous, they're gaining nothing. It's often in the middle of the night where they will stay up with someone and help them get their baby to latch on. Or they will turn up at someone's holiday house with a child's soft toy because the favourite soft toy wasn't brought on the holiday and someone, a Mumsnet lives locally and has that soft toy. Amazing things that kind of inspire you about human nature, to be honest, and make you realise that there's a, there's something about ordinary individuals and how they will go out of their way to be helpful that's really inspiring. Having said that, lots of people, I've taken inspiration from lots of people. Very early, in my very early days, it was Bill Shankly and the way that he created a community around Liverpool Football Club and a sense of purpose that was bigger than the sum of the parts and always believed in the team. And that would be too many people to mention, really. But
I think Bill Shankly's a pretty good one, to be honest with you. Bill Shankly's a great one. And in these 22 years, then, looking back, and I'm sure there's much more to come, that's going to be my last question, but what are you most proud of?
I suppose I'm partly proud that we're still here. It's a fairly grueling thing to sort of run your own business, but also run such a sort of public, which has attracted its fair share of kind of, well, criticism. It's been targeted in a number of ways. And I would say there are some people that would rather we weren't in existence and that women weren't collecting and organising and having a community online.
Yeah.
So I'm pleased we're still here. And I'm pleased
here and thriving, Justine. Come on.
And I'm pleased that we still have our values. We have our values and we live by them and we know what they
You've
are.
You've done it your
we know
way.
Why we're here. Yeah. We know what we're doing. And we don't always do it the way other people would like us to, but we do put our users at heart and centre of what we do. And I think people have derived value from that, a lot of value, actually.
And so the obvious final question is, what next? What next for you? What next for Mumsnet?
Our job is to facilitate the conversation that allows people to get answers to questions. That's why people come. They get great answers to their questions. So we just need to make sure we're sort of, if you like, kind of technology neutral in that and to deliver those answers in the way that people want them answered. And mums who are pregnant people now, what do they expect from a platform that facilitates them finding those answers? So we're quite mindful of that, how we need to make sure that we're pretty neutral about what it is, what the technology is, as long as we are true to our purpose. So that means exploring lots of different ways of delivering that, really. And we haven't spoken about it, but I would say one of the biggest mistakes I've made over the course of time is not sort of keeping up to date with the technology fast enough, allowing technical debt to get into the company that takes a long time to unpick. And I think we're through that now and ready to sort of develop. And we've got a great team. So we're excited about what we can build for our users.
Mumsnet on the metaverse, something like that. Is that what you're thinking?
Sorry, well, if I understood what it was, maybe. might be a fast follower there.
Exactly. I think that's probably the good idea. So, Justine, it's been absolutely fantastic having you on. Thank you so much. Really inspirational. What a great story. And I've loved talking to you. So thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Nice to meet you, Chris. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.